what? It's been a crazy couple of weeks since we talked last.
It certainly has. And none of it is my fault.
Are you sure? Because are you the reason Pope Benedict resigned?
No. No, I wasn't even there when that happened.
Okay.
And I wasn't in Russia when that meteor hit either.
Okay. And you weren't at the Beyond Cana marriage retreat that we spent my husband and I spent 3 days working on.
Well, no, but I should have been. And I didn't see you at the conference that I went to, or the convention.
No, and you were there for 3 days, right?
3 days with my daughter.
I should have gone through.
Yes.
But you were there when we saw that we're finalists in the About.com Catholicism 2013 or 2013 awards, right?
Wow, I was there. I was there. In fact, I had the poor fellow at gunpoint demanding to be one of the finalists.
Good job.
Yep.
And it worked.
Fantastic. I'm glad.
And now I've heard this thing. There's some new amusement park that's something about dinosaurs.
Ooh. It's
live
expensive,
dinosaurs?
I bet you it's pricey. Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. And hard to get to.
Probably hard to get to. It's a long flight.
And don't try to pet them because you might lose an arm.
Ouch. Is it called Jurassic Park?
It is. You read about it too?
I did read about it too. I read all about it.
Okay.
And for good story number 53.
Ah. Which, on a good story is hard to find.
That's right, which this is.
Yeah. Now you have to say the other line.
Oh,
see, this
two
time.
Catholics talking about books, movies, and the traces of the one reality they find there.
Yes.
All right. Hey, that's the first time I've said that.
I know. I always say that. I like when you say it.
Hey, that's cool. We're mixing it up today, folks.
Yep.
That's right. That's right.
Doing something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
Like having live dinosaurs in a park.
Yes, which is...
Hey, I thought it was funny. I liked it.
Fantastic. So yeah, if you haven't guessed, we're going to talk about Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton. A book so good that they ought to make a movie.
Oh, mm-hmm. Hey, have you heard?
Have I heard?
They made a movie that was kind of different, but still good.
Oh, get out of town. Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Only made $900 million, I think.
Is it the biggest grossing movie of all time? I know it was at one time.
Is it?
I don't know. It was at one time, but that's fantastic. That movie has the most perfect action scene I've ever seen.
Which one?
The one with them in the Ford Explorers and the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
With the water?
Oh, yeah. Everything.
That's the iconic scene of that. Mm-hmm. Trembling water is the most brilliant thing ever, which is why you see everybody copying it.
Exactly.
It was one of my favorite parts of Shaolin Soccer. I don't know if you ever saw that. Okay, if you haven't,
I have not. I have not.
I'm not kidding. Shaolin Soccer.
Shaolin Soccer.
I would say mockumentary, but it's not. But it's a movie that's a Hong Kong movie that it kind of makes fun of those soccer sports movies, but it mixes it up with like being a Hong Kong movie.
Ooh, cool. Sounds like everything that I like.
Yeah. And he does a lot of Western references, and that's one of the references where you just start laughing your head off because they're all looking at something in the liquid shake, and you're like, oh, no, and, you know.
Well, cool. I definitely need to check that out. Writing that down.
Yep.
Shaolin Soccer. Very cool. Very cool.
Okay.
Yes. So, Jurassic Park. Good book.
Yeah, it's one of my very favorite books, mm-hmm. which is why I picked it. Not only is it, to me, just about the perfect techno thriller, which was Michael Crichton's specialty, but I kind of resonate with some of the statements he's making about, and he's making some statements about the misuse of science and people's ability to fool themselves into thinking they're doing something for good when actually it's for selfish reasons.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. He does talk a lot about that in there. You know, I come out of here just, I've read this book before. This is the second time I've read the book. My son absolutely loves this book. So he must have read it two or three times in high school. And I read it one summer with him. And Crichton is just brilliant. He's got to be like a genius, because just looking at the books that he's written, super eclectic. I looked this up. So the first book he wrote was The Andromeda Strain in 1969. And then The Terminal Man. Yeah, and then The Terminal Man. So these are both sort of medical thrillers, right?
Right.
And then the next book he writes is The Great Train Robbery. And then he writes Eaters of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then he writes Congo and Sphere. And then Jurassic Park.
He wrote also the screenplay for Westworld.
Uh-huh, right. Yeah, so he was into movies as well. And he is the creator of ER.
Oh, I've forgotten that.
Yeah, and I know he wrote some scripts for that, but I don't think he wrote very many. And he served on there in some capacity the whole time.
Okay. Well, because he was a medical doctor, I did read a little bit about him because I just thought I would actually, for a change, do a touch of research. Just a little.
Yeah.
But I was interested in the fact that he wanted to be a writer, but because he couldn't get into some program, he wound up becoming a doctor instead. It's like, oh,
which is amazing.
Isn't that the path every would-be writer takes? Well, okay, I'll just become a doctor. And but that's why he then went on, because he always was writing the whole time because he was so interested in it, which is where you get this real interesting blend of very believable scientific type information.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Scenarios, I
and
guess.
And this book is just full of scientific thought. It's a science fiction novel that beats a lot of science fiction novels that are published as science fiction novels. You know, it's just full of ideas, full of things to think about.
Oh, yeah.
It's wrapped up
just
in an action
well
story.
Just as well as being riveting. I mean, by the time you get about two-thirds of the way through, you just start turning the pages faster and faster and faster as he goes from situation to situation, bouncing you back and forth between all the people in danger and trying to get a handle on what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess everybody probably knows the main premise, which is that a Dr. Grant, a paleontologist, and his assistant, Ellie, I think Sadler?
Sadler, I believe, yeah. Sadler. I listened to it. I don't see the name in front of me.
Oh, okay. Yep. They were called away from their dig in Wyoming by a major contributor, John Hammond, who wanted them to check something out. And when they get there, they find out it's an island near Costa Rica, I think.
Yep.
And they have managed to recreate dinosaurs, live dinosaurs. And so it's them and it's Gennaro, I think is how you say it, who's the kind of the insurance guy, but he's the guy that the backers have sent to make sure it's safe and that they don't need to shut this thing down.
Right, right.
Because there have been rumors of, oh, babies getting partially eaten, workers torn in half kind of thing.
Yep.
And also Ian Malcolm, who is, I would say, the hero of the piece, actually.
he's my favorite.
Yeah, and he's, of course, you know, you can never beat how he was portrayed in the movie by Jeff Goldblum. But
yeah, and going through the book, you know, ever since I've seen that, you know, all the characters are very well cast.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the kids are different, but everybody else is, you know, just works in the book. And I don't know, when you read, do you have pick people in your head when you read?
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever pick actors, even if it's not on purpose?
Somehow somebody
does that. I do that sometimes when.
But you told me you do.
Yeah, and
this one,
and with the Harry Potter books, you know, when I read those, permanently those actors are in those spots.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, even though I read the book, of course, before, and the Harry Potter books before they cast them.
Yeah, there was a couple of lines even that Malcolm said that seemed to be written for Jeff Goldblum, just the way he speaks. So
yeah, he's kind of a
in that first half of the book,
kind of amusingly obnoxious fellow.
Right.
But the thing when he's like, "Well, the fences have failed," and says one guy, and Malcolm goes, "Did they?" And he's like, "You shut up."
Well, he spends the last half of the book
fence
in
integrity would fail.
A morphine haze. So he says a lot of crazy stuff after the halfway point.
Oh, yeah. Yep. He gets to have a lot of monologues, essentially. But they're yeah, so whenever well
they walk,
done.
Yeah, whenever they walk in there, he's like, okay, time for a speech from Malcolm.
Well, and especially when, you know, and you're kind of like, yay, I'm going to cheer you on when he's saying, you're a bigger fool than I thought you were. Mm-hmm. And I thought you were a very substantial fool. Like, thank right. you. I mm. hate John Hammond. He was definitely the villain.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest difference between the movie and this book is the character of John Hammond, who yes. has no redeeming qualities in the book. But in the movie, no. he was kind of a, you know, somebody's grandpa who seemed very kind. Yeah, he made an error.
Yeah,
but here he's like, you know, he wants profit and that's all that this is for.
And yeah, and you're very carefully, his character is kind of very carefully, what, like an onion? The layers mm-hmm. are unpeeled for you because he starts off seeming like that nice character that Richard Attenborough played in the movie. But you see when he's, but he's also got this delusional thing going on because at one point, and we're just going to jump around now, when mm-hmm. the kids are all, everybody's lost in the park and Dr. Wu, mm-hmm. I guess, is saying, we don't know where the kids are. And he's like, oh, that's okay. The park was built for kids. But he's like, no, see, they're in there with the dinosaurs and we don't know where the T-Rex is and et cetera. And he's like, they'll be fine. That park wouldn't hurt them. And he said, while he's eating this ice cream, and you're just like, oh, you are certifiable. But by the end, when they're showing what he really thinks, which is, you know, the kids have been playing with the dinosaur roar and the speaker, and he fell down and hurt his ankle, and he's thinking, you know, the only reason I had those kids come here was to show this guy that the park was okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah. so you see he's used every single person there.
Yeah, for sure.
Deliberately.
Yeah, and he has. And yeah, he's all about making money. I remember mm-hmm. one spot where somebody was talking to him about doing things that are good for humanity. And he actually gave yeah. a little speech where he's like, you don't do stuff that's good for humanity. You know, that's a risky
right.
business.
I love that.
That's a risky business. You want to do stuff that's for entertainment. Because nobody needs it, and therefore nobody will mess around with it.
Yeah, because later on then he's talking about the children will want to see it, at least the rich children.
At least the rich kids, right.
Yeah.
He's talking about, yeah, we could charge $5,000 a ticket, which sounds like a lot, but it actually will increase the appeal of the park. You know, so he's just yes. constantly thinking about all this while all this horror is going around. I mean, going on all over the park, and his grandkids are missing, and... yeah, he was just despicable.
Yes. Well, and it's funny because that concentration on money is so founded in what seems to make good sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then he's got that unreal part also where he's, what was it? Oh, Wu says at one point that he goes, you know, I think we should re-engineer the dinosaurs. They're real, but they're unsatisfactory. They're unconvincing. I could make them better.
Mm-hmm.
And Hammond says, what? How could you make them better? And he says, well, they're moving too fast. People aren't accustomed to large animals that are fast.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to look real. And he goes, but they are real. And he goes, yes, but we need them to be more domesticated. And he goes, nobody wants domesticated dinosaurs, Hammond says. And Wu says, no, I think they do. I think they want to see what they expect.
Yeah.
And he's actually kind of right, I think.
Yeah, probably so.
Because mm-hmm. it's entertainment. It's not a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, interesting.
Won't listen to anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing I did like, now that we've gotten done just ripping Hammond apart, which I will continue doing throughout this podcast.
Yes.
So we can all look forward to that. but is that except for, you know, some of the just, I guess, side characters, Crichton is pretty fair to everyone, even the people that he really likes, like Grant and Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
He's not letting them off the hook really either. I mean, everybody's shown to have their good and their bad side. There are things that they allow themselves to be blind to and the things they care about and are responsible with. Because like at one point, Malcolm says, he's talking about, oh, the planet and everything. And he goes, yeah, how does one of your digs look after you're done? And she's like, and he goes, right. What do you do with all the money you get? She goes, well, we do it for the dig. And he goes, right, but there's never anything left to put things back the way they were because it's just the Badlands. It's just this and that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really dwelt upon, but you see that they're real people in that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's the fallible as well as the idealistic that's being lived out there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that's a really interesting aspect of this whole thing is, and especially satisfying to me is how he kind of got into everything like that. So you're right in that he's not letting anybody off the hook. But at the same time, the whole book seems to be a discussion about, science and limits and, whether it's good or bad. I recall a whole discussion about, you know, science tells us that we can build a nuclear reactor, but it doesn't tell us if we should build a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
And, it's kind of the same, you know, everyone in there is a scientist, you know, Ellie and Dr. Grant, you know, they're scientists too. And the question extends to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of fascinating how the whole thing, and then it's all wrapped up in this chaos theory, which, you know, the whole book, you know, even the chapter headings are, you know, iteration one, iteration two,
right.
You know, the whole thing is kind of a, you know, in a whole chaos theory envelope,
yeah,
you know, is the impression he kind of gives you by naming all the chapters the way he did and bringing it up all the time. Cause that's Ian Malcolm's into chaos theory.
Yeah, and he's the only one that's shown to really not have a flaw.
Yeah.
He's obviously his ideal character, I think.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Even though Grant is really the true one that you're following, and he's having to do the hero stuff.
Right. Him and the kids are out in the wilderness for most of the book and trying to get them back in. And yeah. Yeah.
Well, and at the end, he's the one who is forcing Gennaro to take some personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'll be responsible. He goes, no, not telling someone to push a button. You're coming out and counting raptor eggs with us.
You bet.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So he's also a hero, but not in the same way that Ian Malcolm is. Because, yeah, you're right. To me, the theme of the book is just because we can do something, should we do it?
Right.
And that echoes through so much of what we're living with today and the kind of decisions people make and consider.
It dovetails into the whole science versus religion discussion, although he doesn't talk a lot about religion in this. Fact, I can't remember where he brought it up. But the fact that the Catholic Church is always standing up and saying, wait a minute,
mm-hmm.
is that piece that science is missing. You know,
yes.
Science says, yeah, we can build this bomb, but the Catholic Church is one of the things in the world that stands up and says, should we do that? That's probably not a good idea. You know, and with the cloning, you know, why are we doing cloning? Maybe we can do it, but why should we, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one of the organizations on the planet that stands up and talks that way, and it's vitally important.
Well, and what's funny is because they have a consistent stand across all disciplines and all lines, the church, I mean, and people don't tend to look at the issue as one issue, like, say, the life issue. They think because they look at just this pocket and that pocket, they're like, man, all they do is say no to this and no to that, no cloning, no stem cell, no, you know, whatever. And it's like, no, what they're doing is saying, yes, life.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, life as it should be. Yeah, you know, yes, use adult stem cells. Don't destroy embryos for it. You know, we're supporting the weakest among us.
What the Catholic Church
is
against is having abortions and using fetuses for stem cells.
Right. They're standing up for the babies.
But they're not against stem cell research. You know, that's one of those things that's out there that just was never right.
Yeah, and the adult stem cell stuff that you can do without you know, killing someone.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're helping lead the research is what I've heard.
Yeah.
I'd have to look that up, but
yeah,
they have a lot of scientists.
Done some things to, you know, donate to the cause.
Right.
Is what I understand. So,
yeah. Well, and the, because then there's things like, you know, against the death penalty, not in places where you have to have something like that to keep the wolves away from the sheep, so to speak, like Africa where the warlords are.
Yeah. Yep.
But in a country like this, which is rich enough that we can afford to keep people shut away and give them a chance for, you know, to, oh, how would you say it, to have spiritual development of their own, you know, while protecting everybody else.
Yeah. And that's a, I mean, that's a difficult thing, but you know, we're, you know, as life is the common element here.
Right.
Right. It's the respect for life. And, that's what the church keeps standing up and talking about. What about this? You know, don't, you know, that's that we can see the end of that one and that's not a good end, you know? And, there's science itself doesn't do that, which is one of Michael Crichton's points of this book. Science itself says, hey, we can do that. Let's do it. And there's no real thought about consequences. There's nothing inherent in the science that will tell you what a consequence is going to be or to tell you whether or not you should do something.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of times what the church is saying is let's not jump into stuff.
Right.
Let's stop and take a considered look. And kind of the key statement for me of the book, you know, in one of Ian Malcolm's speeches, he says, scientific power is like inherited wealth. It's attained without discipline. And the point he keeps making is that kind of scientific power, like with the cloning or whatever, is there's no discipline, no mastery, and no humility. And that's what's dangerous.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the old way of science, which was just what's out there, let's look, is not around much anymore, according to him.
Yeah.
Because even the people that you think are actually doing that, like Ellie and Grant, aren't being as careful as they should either, is what he says.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all true.
I mean, I can't agree with everything Ian Malcolm says, because although he makes the point about, you know, cavemen were working 24 hours a week to, you know, gather their berries and whatever. And then the rest of the time they could just enjoy this beautiful environment. And they didn't need all this. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. I think they still had a lot of diseases that I'm happy were cured. And I think, you know, I like having heater. I'm just saying, you know,
I like to live past 20.
Yeah. So, of course, now he was making outrageous statements because that's what he does. But and so he kind of paints this fantasy of it. But he's kind of saying the scientific age is over because science has kind of failed.
Yeah.
How did you feel about that when he was saying that?
Well, I don't things are really weird. Things are really weird right now. I mean, in science. You know, I read a book a long time ago by Stephen Hawking in which he kind of chuckled about somebody saying that physics is done because we figured everything out. And then he said that himself like 2 or 3 years ago that we're much near the end of physics. And I'm just like, you know, the one thing that I think that we can know as a species right now is that we don't know everything. I think that's the only thing that we can for surely say.
Preach it.
Yeah. So it's so science right now, you know, because I'm in the science fiction world and I think the science fiction world mirrors a little bit the science world because the science kind of feeds the science fiction and it feeds the speculation. Science fiction as a field in the ideas sense has really kind of shriveled on the vine in the past, say 10, 20 years, in my opinion. And that's because science, it's kind of gotten into this multiple universes and, people keep talking about the singularity, which
stuff you can't prove
stuff that can't be, you know, it's like turned into this nebulous, kind of non-concrete thing that's going on, you know? And it's tapped out because, you know, from where I'm sitting, and it could be that the science is so complicated that I'm not able to see what physicists are doing and things, right? But from where I'm sitting, in the past 20 years, I haven't seen progress in a way that I could actually measure. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm so smart that I ought to be able to measure it. I know that there's stuff going on out there, but it's gone into a direction. It's a very, very small, you know, multiple universes, like I said, you know, this quantum computing thing, which is actually a way of saying, you know, your computer calculations may be going on in a parallel universe and coming back to us, you know,
and I was going, what?
And everybody's just like, you know, well, they're talking about quantum computers as if they're a done deal, but they're not a done deal. You know, it's a theory. It's something that they think might be possible. But, you know, then at the same time, I think about there are some incredible things. Like, it's been proven that you can quantumly wiggle something over here, and then something over there will respond instantaneously, which starts a whole, you know, bunch of, I mean, the applications are endless, you know. But it's only at the very, there's a TED talk by a guy who, talked some about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I'll try to look it up. If I can find it, I'll send you the link. I can't even remember the fellow's name. But personally, I'd have to say, you know, as someone who, you know, I don't watch science daily or I don't read physics books and stuff, but as kind of a layperson who's interested in science, the most interesting stuff to me lately, and by lately, again, I mean like the last 20 years, is this chaos theory stuff, which has captured my attention and is endlessly fascinating to me. And this book was written in 1990, so this is 30 years old now.
Yes.
But there's a book by James Gleick called Chaos, which my dad and I both read and just thought was fantastic. And then Ian Malcolm in this book explains chaos theory very, very well. And it's a fascinating thought process. And it does dovetail into views of a creator and things. I would imagine, you know, chaos theory is one of those things that, that people look at, and if they're atheist, they say C, and if you're a religious person, you say C. You know, everybody's kind of like in agreement with, you know, isn't this amazing? You know, so it's one of those things where if there's a creator, it's just absolutely amazing that the design of it. And if there's not a creator, it's just amazing that it's that way. You know what I mean?
Well, and yeah, for me, I know I told you about that book called Seven Glorious Days.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And that goes along with, I was having a conversation this weekend with somebody, and I was telling them about that book. And they said, well, what about mass extinctions and things like that? How do they talk about that? And I said, well, this is that open-ended idea, like the weather. Which is, you know, that thing of, you know, the butterfly flaps, it swings over here and it rains over there. But basically that it's all designed to take all these variables and the system overall still works. It's like a self-correcting thing, which is like our free will.
Yeah. Yeah,
is exactly. Also an open-ended system where, and I'm just like, that's the level of trust and goodness of God's creation. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. He's not going to feel threatened by that.
The ultimate system disturbance is free will.
Right. And it's made to handle the planned stuff and the unplanned stuff. Because guess what? He's just that crazy good, you know?
My goodness, yeah. Now so, I'm just looking at Jurassic Park in a whole new light. Because the human free will screwed up this whole system. You know, you talk about it, how it was open-ended. Well, you've got the actions. Oh, what's that fellow's name who was the computer programmer that...
Dennis Nedry.
Now in the movie, he looked like he was planning to leave, right? But in the book, it was pretty clear that he wasn't a terrible person. He was not trying to cause havoc. He felt he was wronged by Jurassic Park because he was doing all this work and he kept getting more work and he wasn't getting any more pay. And they were like, hey, your contract's your contract. So he felt wronged. So what he was going to do is take some of these dinosaur embryos and smuggle them off the island and get a whole bunch of money for that. And he felt justified in doing that because he felt wronged. Okay. But his plan was to just shut the system down, run and deliver these things to somebody that was on the island. He wasn't leaving. And then he was going to come back and turn it on and nobody would ever know.
Right.
But unfortunately that didn't happen. He got eaten.
That was unfortunate, especially the way they described it was very unfortunate.
Yeah. And remember in the movie, there's like, Newman. But the, here he didn't do that. He didn't create any problems in the system. He put like, you know, and even the computer stuff Michael Crichton describes, that's why I just think he's so brilliant, because a lot of times when you read these techno thrillers, you roll your eyes because the way he's describing the computers is ridiculous, you know, but he's doing a perfect job here.
But this stuff all makes sense.
It totally makes sense. Control systems is what I do for a living. And this was really cool. Yeah. And then, you know, he found the line of code, which shut down the system, and he's like, oh, you know, so in the movie they did kind of a more complicated, well, I don't know, more dramatic is the word I'm looking for, way to turn the system back on and everything. But anyway, I thought it was great. But it was interesting in the book that Nedry was not a bad guy. He was just, he felt wronged. And the whole thing was an accident. It was a, you know, the...
Yeah, that, you know, everything went so he, spun yeah, out of he, control.
Right. So he's Malcolm's talking about chaos theory. Quick explanation of chaos theory that Malcolm did is if you have like a, let's say a cannonball, and you shoot it at the same angle or at the certain angle with a certain weight ball, right? You shoot it and then it lands somewhere. And then if you shoot that thing again with the exact same size ball and the exact same cannon, it's going to land in pretty much exactly the same place. Okay. And he said that's a linear system, but a chaotic system is one like the weather, which you start off with the same temperature and the same wind conditions and everything, and then you let it go and something happens, like a storm maybe. And then you start with a slightly tiny difference in those initial conditions and you may end up with a sunny day.
Well, and I liked his example of the drop of water on the back of your hand.
Right. That was good.
You can hold your hand at the exact angle and you drop a drop of water, and you drop the same kind of a drop of water, and it goes in a different place because there's all these little irregularities that we can't see.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's reacting to that.
So yeah, it stays on the surface of your hand. And that's the idea of that there's a limit. One of the examples in the chaos book was a leaf. You know, you can get 100 leaves and compare them to each other and they're not the same, yet they're all the same type of leaf.
But they're the same.
So you've got like some kind of a boundary that we can't see, yet the chaos keeps forming these maple leaves. And we know that they're maple leaves, but they're all different.
Yeah. And we've come to expect that, but if you draw a maple leaf, you're going to draw the same leaf as much as you can every time.
Right, exactly.
Because
exactly.
we tend to like to lock things down that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, he says chaos theory teaches us that straight linearity, which we have come to take for granted in everything from physics to fiction, simply does not exist. Linearity is an artificial way of viewing the world. Real life isn't a series of interconnected events occurring one after another like beads strung on a necklace. Life is actually a series of encounters in which one event may change those that follow in a wholly unpredictable, even devastating way. Malcolm sat back in his seat, looking toward the other land cruiser a few yards ahead. That's a deep truth about the structure of our universe, but for some reason, we insist on behaving as if it were not true. And it says, at that moment, the cars jolted to a stop. Example. But, and it's that funny thing of, you know, something awful happens and you're jolted out of the world. And I still remember when Desert Storm happened in Iraq, and my brother was there. And it was such a big deal that I was at the grocery store that evening, and they announced it. They had the Muzak on and they stopped it to put the radio announcement of it on. that the war had started. And I remember suddenly looking at all those other people who didn't even stop to hear what was being said and just being furious at them. Because my world had changed. Not only just the fact of the war, but thinking of my brother being there made it feel much more personal. And they were just kind of walking around still shopping and laughing with their kids and everything. And it was that, but it's that kind of chaos theory thing of, it took me out of that idea of everything's just normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what
maybe a side issue, but you know, I believe that if we're going to be at war, you know, our lives should be different. And I understand that yours was, but we should all.
Yes.
We, you know, this country just keeps going on without any pain. I mean, I realize we've got economic pain, but I'm just saying that I think you understand what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
We need to be invested. If we're going to do that, we need to be invested. And
it should matter.
It should matter.
And it doesn't matter if all it is the stock market's going up and down.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
That's not enough.
Because these are people's lives. On both sides.
No question. Yep.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
That's not what you call just war at that point.
Right.
You want to go for something that that people don't think about the Catholic Church talking about? It's just war.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a whole different conversation. But but the thing that, and that's the point that keeps being made, though, is, you know, you were talking about free will and chaos theory and describing them. And the other point that's being made is, for one thing, you can't account for what people are going to do with their free will. And they kept saying, but these are animals. Animals that are intelligent to varying degrees. Animals that are going to act both as their natures prompt them and as different circumstances come up. They're going to take advantage of those, or it will make them react in a way. And everybody who planned the park and everybody who's in the park pretty much goes around acting like they're exhibits behind bars in a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Muldoon doesn't. He's the Australian animal big game hunter who's there to kind of handle that aspect of it, to control the animals. And the scientists don't, you know, Dr. Grant and Ellie don't. But the Jurassic Park people, I mean, you know, one of the first telltales is when Ellie's looking at the plants planted around the swimming pool, I think it was.
Oh, yeah.
And a whole bunch of them are really poisonous because they're like, oh, these are real authentic Jurassic plants. And they're like, yeah, but they might kill a baby who took a bite of one. You guys weren't being careful or thinking at all.
Yeah. And if you weren't careful about the plants.
Oh, yeah.
What about the rest of these giant animals, for heaven's sakes? Yeah.
And that's the thing, the point that Malcolm makes is, you know, Dr. Wu, he doesn't even know the names of half of the things that are out there, but he's just blithely creating them like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. 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 Interesting. You know, and I just love this book for how it portrays that exact thing, how the, you know, you talked about initial conditions, you know, the whole Nedry thing is a perturbation of the system that puts this chaotic wave or chaotic element into the whole thing. And then he, of course, ends up dying before he can come back and turn everything back on.
Yeah.
And now everything's a mess. Now you're in total chaos.
And they think they've turned it back on, but they haven't turned it all back on.
Yep.
Or not permanently so. And what they've done is drain the actual backup generator and can't get the real power back on. And then everything's out. And that's when Muldoon goes, "You mean the Raptor's pen's been down for 5 hours? Okay." And he starts handing out guns and talking very fast.
Yeah.
And you hear screams. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Holy
they figured
cow.
It out.
Yep. Just something else. Yep.
Yeah. Which made me think, oh, I know what I was going to say. I don't know if you thought of this, but talking about chaos theory.
Mm-hmm.
We've already talked about a book that actually describes chaos theory really well. And I'm going to read this to you.
Okay.
God maintains the world in existence in a state of continual change. Day passes into night, spring into summer, summer into autumn, autumn into winter, and winter into spring. And no 2 days are ever exactly alike, some being cloudy, some rainy, some dry, some windy, a variety which makes the world all the more beautiful. This same law of change applies to man, who has been called an epitome of the world, for his state is ever changing, constantly in movement.
his life on earth like waters which ebb and flow, sometimes lifted up by hope, sometimes depressed by fear, swept one way by consolation, another by affliction, no day, no hour, exactly the same. And that's St. Francis de Sales.
That's the introduction to the devout life.
Introduction to the devout life has chaos theory for us.
How about that?
Just not applied to a scientific system.
Right. And how long ago was that?
That was 600 years ago.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly.
Yeah.
Crazy. Gotta love that.
But what happens is we've forgotten it because we like to look at everything so concretely, which is what's pointed out in this book, is it's like, it's only a computer system. No big deal. It's only these animals. No big deal. Because we think we understand all the facts about it. And we think that the facts and the scientifically proven things is all that matters.
Yeah.
And that's what leaves out chaos theory, which is sometimes it's things that we can't predict that are scientific, but a lot of times it's that intangible stuff.
Yeah.
Like what drives Dennis Nedry? Gee, if they'd have been more fair, if they'd have given him more help, if they'd have said, we'll pay your overage fees, all the things that went to his state of mind, even though he was wrong to do what he did, he was motivated by something that was intangible. And to save a few bucks, they pushed him in a direction they didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the intangibles that matter when you're talking about people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right. Those waves in the system. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the whole thing as some scientific system, then, yeah, you've created an initial condition that creates a pretty big effect down the road.
Yeah, you've poured something into that open-ended system that comes out with something weird at the other end.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Excellent stuff. So, you know, I said to you right before the podcast that I felt that, you know, Jurassic Park, the movie, has significant differences from the book. But I think, you know, if I was giving a class or something, you know, with my limited knowledge of how to turn a book into a movie, this would be one of the prime examples. This is a definite success from book to movie.
Yeah.
Even with the differences.
Well, I was going to say you have to adapt things in such a way that you're carrying the gist of the story and communicating it more quickly than you do in a book because you've got less time.
Right, right.
You know, you can't tell a lot of the internal stuff. You have to communicate it in different ways. And although I deeply, deeply disapprove of their portrayal of John Hammond because they didn't want to have him be a bad guy.
Yeah, I wonder why they made that decision. Just because they wanted him to be appealing?
Yeah, because Dennis Nedry is a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And John Hammond is a little, he's kind of more of a bumbler. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got some not nice motivations, but in the end, he's like, oh, definitely, I'll help blow this island up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he ultimately cares about the grandkids. Oh, you know, thank goodness you're safe, etc.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's actually a really bad guy other than Nedry.
No, and I think that's one of the appeals of the book. I mean, you know, like Nedry, in the movie, he was worse than he is here. He made mistakes here. In that one, he did seem to be malicious.
Yes.
So they made him more of a clear-cut type of a bad guy. You know, and he got his in the movie, too.
Well, that was one of the best parts. You have to leave that in. That's establishing a lot of things there.
Right. So then they changed the character of Hammond to be more pleasant. And then they, the kids, we haven't even talked about the kids hardly.
Right.
The kids in the book, Tim is the older one and Lexi is the smaller one. But Lexi really didn't have a purpose other than to be someone who needed to be saved, you know, because they gave the computer expertise and the dinosaur interest to the boy.
Right.
But then in the movie, they split that up and they made the girl older and she was the computer whiz. And then the boy was smaller and he was the dinosaur expert. And then they also took Alan Grant and gave him a love interest with his assistant, who was also a doctor, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And the older girl was used to play on that.
And they also made him, this was something I really didn't like in the movie. And, you know, I was like, oh, love interest, fine. Mm-hmm. But the other thing they did, though, was make him, I don't understand children.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in the book, it was much more realistic that he loved kids because they loved dinosaurs as much as he did and often knew a lot of the technical stuff because they were just so into it.
Right, right.
Which is why he was able to bond with Tim, because nobody understood Tim. But he did,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting to look at those choices that they made and see if they were successful or not, yeah. you know.
Well, and it was okay.
Overall, it was a successful movie. I mean, clearly it was successful, but was it good? Right. You know, I think it was good. I think it was a very good movie.
Oh, yeah. It's one of those things that's funny because I always think of Jurassic Park as a B-movie,
mm-hmm.
the most expensive B-movie in history. But, you know, because it's not what it could have been. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to add more things out of the book. I understand why they couldn't put everything in. That, you know, there just wasn't room. But it could have been, if they'd have been a little truer to some of the characters and been a little braver about pushing some of that stuff some,
mm-hmm.
I think it could have been more of a, I don't know, just something that wasn't just a summer blockbuster.
Yeah, maybe so.
And I haven't seen it for a while, so maybe I'm not giving it enough credit. But I remember when I first saw it, I was like, oh, it's okay. I'm really disappointed because they didn't put some key things in, like some of those characters, the way they were in the book. But it's also a movie that I can never resist watching if I'm flipping around and it's on TV mm-hmm. or somebody brings it over. I'm like, let's watch it. You know, it's not a bad movie at all, but for me, it's a B movie. It's no Inception. And it could have been closer, you know, not to that level depth of thinking, but it could have been a contender.
You bet. It sure could have. Yep. Interesting. I am pleased with how much they kept.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, to have Jeff Goldblum talking chaos theory was very neat. And, you know, I'm glad that they left that in because that was really kind of the point of it all.
Oh, yeah.
And they needed him to stay that way to do that. So,
Well, and my gosh, that movie gave us some of the most riveting scenes ever. I mean, just as I dissed it, but I mean, that whole thing with the velociraptors in the kitchen.
Oh, man.
Yep. Every time I watch it, I just get tense.
Yeah. And I said this earlier in a podcast, but the perfect action scene to me is the first time the Tyrannosaurus Rex shows up and they're in the Ford Explorers and it's throwing those explorers around.
Yeah.
The lawyer runs off to the bathroom to hide. Ian Malcolm doesn't know what to do, so he starts waving his arms. And Alan Grant knows that if you stand still, they can't see you, so he's trying to explain that. And mm-hmm. all in this, it was great.
Great. With in the fact, dinosaur shoving that glass.
Yeah, and the same scene was in the book, and the book was even more intense. You know, it was clearly they had to decide what they were capable of doing. Mm-hmm. But in the film, but there was one point in the book where the Tyrannosaurus Rex, both kids are in this van, and it picks up the van and starts shaking it until one of the kids falls out. I was like, oh man, you know,
just like I know, well, just smokes. Like an enraged dog or something, you know, you
this 7-year old girl falls out of this van into the mud and, you know, it was tough.
Yeah. But I may have to watch the movie again now. I didn't have time before this, but I just kind of, some of the way they showed some of those scenes though, the way the dinosaur would put its head down or the Tyrannosaurus and just roar to try to get someone to move.
Mm-hmm.
And they did do a lot of that kind of stuff in the movie that really, really showed a lot of it so well.
Yeah, they did a good job.
Like that big hunt of the Hadrosaurs?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they showed in the movie, and they may have shown those, but when they were running and everybody, Grant and the two kids are in the field and they're having to get out of the way of the stampeding and the Tyrannosaurus mm-hmm. and
all that That's stuff. All in there. It was neat.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, wow. Well, that was a terrific choice.
Well, I'm glad you liked it.
I absolutely thought it was terrific. You know, neat pick for this. It was, you know, just cool. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if people are listening who haven't read it, just going, I know enough about it, and you do really. Mm-hmm. But I started reading it, and this book's an older one, so it's got small print. It gave me credit for being able to read. And I'm sorry, my private peeve. But the thing is I started reading, and I went, I'm never going to get this book done in time. But it reads so fast.
Oh, yeah.
To me.
And I listened to the audiobook, and it just flew. It just flew. And I had trouble finding the audio, by the way. It's not at Audible. Yeah. The Chivers audiobooks is who has it, and they're British. So
Chivers.
Yeah, Chivers.
Is that C-H?
C-H-I-V-E-R-S.
Okay.
And, yeah, amazing that. There's a big hole there. I'm not sure why. If they're going to try to re-release it, maybe is there like a 30th anniversary or something? Oh. I'm just guessing, you know, you flood the place with Jurassic Park books again or something. But, okay. You know, sure could happen.
Oh, but isn't right it now, coming out in 3D?
Oh, I would believe that, but shoot.
You know what? I think Hannah or somebody said it's coming out in 3D and they're like, and she's like, why? It was done so long ago and it doesn't need it. And I just said the same thing. I'm like, oh, shoot.
Oh, look at that. Really? Yep. JurassicPark.com. It says Jurassic Park 3D. And I'm looking for a date. I don't see a date. Close. Yeah, I don't see a date, but you're right. 4/5/13. It's coming right up.
Oh, my goodness.
Hey,
it is.
This is a timely podcast then.
Well, who knew?
We're ahead of the curve.
That's as always, of course. As always.
Yes, indeed.
You pick an old enough book and it's current again.
Gosh, why 3D? I just don't understand 3D. I honestly just don't.
No, me either.
Is it because I'm old? I don't know.
No, it's because you're right, because I agree with you.
my daughter's 12 and she thinks it's dumb. But she may think it's dumb because I do. I don't know. Yeah. But I have not had a positive 3D experience yet.
No, my only good 3D experience was watching Life of Pi. Mm-hmm. And yet, for the goodness of it, it wasn't integral to the experience.
Yeah,
I could think of the parts that it probably made better. I mean, in the credits, they did some clever things. And I can think of things they did better. Did you see it? At all?
I saw Life of Pi, but not
okay.
in 3D.
So, you know, when they're looking down through the water and up at the stars.
Mm, yeah.
I have a feeling that probably enhanced it, but I think that would work fine without it. So I don't get it. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I don't know.
People
who love it. There must be people who do.
We went and saw Finding Nemo in 3D.
How was that?
Fairly recent, you know, and it was all right, you know, but you know,
amming with faint praise.
You know, when you watch a Pixar movie, for example, without those glasses on, it's crystal clear, sharp, incredible hairs on the monsters, you know, mm-hmm. just incredible. And then you put you go to a 3D one and it's dimmer, right?
Yeah.
And it's not as clear.
Yeah, it's not sharp.
It's not sharp at all. And
so why do it?
I just don't understand it.
You know, you want 3D, get that thing that, you know, what is the thing you look through and you click it and it moves the little wheels.
Oh, yeah, the ViewMaster.
Thank you. Get a ViewMaster.
Right.
I could look at those all day long.
But yeah, it didn't enhance that movie at all. And they're coming out with Monsters, Inc. in 3D. If they haven't already, they're going to.
I'm never going to watch it.
Yeah.
Yes, people will.
So Monsters University is coming out soon.
Oh,
the sequel to Monsters,
Inc.
Oh,
that I want to see for sure.
Yeah, that I want to see, but I won't see it in 3D.
No.
I hope, you know, that we continue to have that choice. I fear that sometime they're just going to say, everybody watch 3D because it's $10 instead of $7 or whatever.
Then I'm going to have to deny myself the pleasure of those experiences.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies I haven't seen yet that I could watch instead.
That's for sure.
I'm just saying.
Yep, yep.
Well, so have you been reading any other good books? I'm just assuming we're done talking about Jurassic
Sure.
Park.
Yeah, I'm actually right in between books right now. I read some short stuff short stuff for the Reading Envy thing that I'm doing, trying to keep up with Jenny, which is,
I like to read your story synopses.
It's fun. It's fun. I read The Cloak by Nikolai Gogol and The Halfling by Lee Brackett just recently. So, yeah. Anyway, fun stuff. And then I came home from that convention with a stack of books by local authors that
I saw.
I'm excited about, and I still want to get those read.
Enviable stack.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, the best panel that I went to it was given by a lady named Sandra Taylor. Her husband is Howard Taylor, who is he draws a web comic called Schlock Mercenary.
He's one of the podcasts.
The Writing Excuses folks.
That's it. Yeah.
So people may not be familiar with his story, but this is, he took the bold step of leaving a job that he was making plenty of money at and going to be a cartoonist full time on the web, where she said the year before they made this decision, they made negative $600.
Oh.
So he came to her and said, "Hey, wouldn't it be a cool idea if?" And so their story is fascinating. Now he's supporting a family of six with Schlock Mercenary.
Good for him.
Yeah, it's really a fantastic story. And she has a blog called One Cobble, ONECOBBLE.
.com.
And she's often describing, life. She's kind of the business person now. She's working for this company now too. So
I was wondering.
Yeah, so now she's like the business end of it and he's the creative end of it. But she's got her own creative stuff going on at the same time.
Okay.
So her panel or presentation was called, and I'm just calling it up here. Sorry that I had it in front of me when we started. It's called Structuring Life for Creativity, I believe.
Oh.
Hold on just a second here.
That's interesting.
Yeah, onecobble.com. I had it in front of me in my notes, and now I can't find it. There it is. Structuring Life to Make Room for Creativity. That was the name of it. And I said, ooh, I need that. So I'm going to go. So I go in there. Place is packed. And she went through a list of 10 things that they have learned as a couple to be able to do what they do.
How interesting.
Yeah. And it is on her website. And I'll put a link on the show notes.
Yeah, definitely.
She wrote the whole thing up on a post the day that she got back from that convention, which was just a godsend. Yeah, really, really nice. But anyway.
We could all use that probably.
Yeah, really super helpful. So again, I'll put the link. It's at onecobble.com if you don't want to wait for the link or if you're just listening.
Right.
ONECOBBLE.com. And the post is the same title as the panel, and it was on, looks like she posted it on February the 18th.
Okay. Well, because that does tie in with the one thing that we kind of touched on it from the book, but that I thought was really kind of important, although it's not really stressed a lot. There's one point in the book where Ian Malcolm is talking about technicians and thintelligence, where all you do is just learn the surface, and because what you're doing is you're narrowing your focus just to learn what you need to know. So you only learn computer systems if that's what you're going to do, or you only learn DNA if you're going to be making dinosaurs, and you don't stop and look at the broader world around you. And it made me think of, you've talked about this before for sure because of your interest in education, but that idea that in the 1920s or 30s when they decided they were going to stop doing liberal educations, meaning classical liberal educations, like you learn all these things. You read Plato, you do math, you do science, you do everything, but it's not all designed to get you a job and make you able to earn a living when you get out of school.
Yeah.
And once they started doing that, all of a sudden school changed and people weren't learning as well anymore and all those various things. And what you're talking about, I don't know what she talked about, but that idea of making room for creativity, because so many of us just leave that element out of our lives altogether, even if it's just something like nobody cooks anymore. How about that?
Yeah, it's because, you know, when you're busy, what are you going to shove aside?
Right.
And exactly. And that's one of the things education in this country has completely wrong, in my opinion. You know, there's a whole kind of a movement that seems to me that is growing, that is realizing that we are educating kids for a system that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Things are constantly changing. You know, if you think about what the ideal product of our educational system should be, is someone who can deal with change, right?
Yeah.
And someone who can, you know, we can understand that whatever they learned in high school is not something that's going to be super helpful for them later on. I don't think I'm stating that correctly. It's like if you spend 4 years in high school learning about Windows 8, okay?
Yeah.
What you will come out of is old knowledge. There is no way for a high school to keep up with that. So how do we respond to that? Well, the response to that, in my opinion, needs to be that we need to teach people to be creative.
And to think.
And to think.
And be curious.
Exactly. And what are we doing is
we're the buying exact a opposite. Windows 10 or whatever.
Yeah, the exact opposite is, you know, this guy Ken Robinson said, we're pounding creativity out of our kids. Because right. by the time they get out of high school, they're so afraid of giving the wrong answer that creativity is gone. We're training them not to be. We're training them exactly the opposite of what is needed.
Yeah, and the ironic thing is, I think the other element to that, which we've talked about before, is because we're so busy focusing on self-esteem, which is, you know, the Invincibles did a good job of pointing that out. You know, give everyone an award so they'll feel good about themselves. Yeah. Well, yeah. But because they've never had to accomplish anything and get the other thing, which is a sense of self-worth.
Yeah, and that's
that
the
allows
other piece
you
of
to fail because you get up and try again.
Yeah,
as you
and you're
yourself.
What you're doing is you're creating a person who is not prepared for the real world where somebody
right.
wins.
Right.
Somebody wins and somebody loses. All the time.
Yeah.
You can't create a world, I don't know, it seems like we're often trying to create the world where everybody's going to be winning. But what that actually does is it brings everybody down rather than trying to push people up. We're pulling the upper ones down to try and create a level.
Two responses. One is the person who's afraid to try anything, and the other one is the person who thinks they believe all that stuff, and they just sit back and wait for it to come because they've been enabled that way.
Exactly.
And neither of those is the real world, and then they're both paralyzed, and they have to go through a very terrible learning curve to be a normal person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I wish I knew that the answer. You know, I think that the answer lies in excellent teachers and overhaul of curriculum. But the thing is, how do you measure an excellent teacher? I don't think that tests are the exact only way to do it, because you're creating the, if you're teaching to a test, you know, this person needs to know how to add these numbers and do this. This is a list of things. That's what the teacher's going to focus on. And I know from my experience in the schools, when I was a kid, the best days were the days where they went off. You know, it was something sparked that would just happen today. And boom, you know, just
the most interesting.
Just last week, you know, I was teaching my confirmation class, and here I've got what they told me to do, and here I've got Pope Benedict resigned. Okay. So I go in there and I've got what they told me to do. And I said, so who's heard about what happened today? They all raised their hands and they wanted to talk about it. So what am I going to do? Yeah. Am I going to say, let's talk about what I'm supposed to talk about?
Or are we going to spend about the fruit of the spirit?
We're
going to
spend 45 minutes talking about the Pope and what he did, what it means, what's going to happen now. When are we going to hear Habemus Papam? What does that mean?
Yeah.
What is a conclave? We talked about all that stuff.
And that's real life.
Because it's real life. That's what's happening. It's what they wanted to hear then. They learned it. If I had said, well, you know, too bad about Pope Benedict. It's kind of a bummer. So how about this stuff, you know, which is what all of school is in a way right now, you know? So I don't know. it's one of those things that, you know, everybody in the upper echelons wants to control everything. They want these results, but yet the people that can make decisions aren't being allowed to do it. So it's like a distrust of kind of a, you know, bureaucratic distrust of the people that are actually in contact with the kids.
Well, and you've also got that whole element of like teachers unions and all that stuff.
Yeah, and that's
there.
The other part of it too. You've got teachers unions.
For Superman documentary.
Yeah, and then that one, you know, there are times when the teachers union does things that are not in the interest of the students.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you've got the people that are in contact with the kids are protecting themselves and sometimes the worst of themselves out of fear that allowing just a crack in this agreement may cause all kinds of people to get fired, as if there's teachers everywhere around the corner and we're just going to be pulling people from wherever, you know. So they're fears, but I don't think that they're legitimate fears. So yeah, but that's a problem too, you know, and waiting for Superman just proves that, you know, you look at the New York public schools and all the stuff that was going on in there and, and that Waiting for Superman, they talked about, Washington DC and their school districts and Michelle Rhee and what she did and the pushback she got from the teachers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's all fascinating. She wrote a book that I want to read. You know, everybody's wanting to blame the teachers and I don't blame the teachers. I think that we need good teachers, and that's absolutely the best marker of a kid being educated, is that the teacher's good. And but the whole thing needs to be changed. What can I say? You know, I don't have all the answers, but all I know is that it's a big problem and it's not any better.
Yep.
And all the stuff that President Obama's talking about right now, I just think is wrong. And President Bush was wrong, too. President Bush, No Child Left Behind thing, it was terrible. No. You know, so.
Yeah. Well, and this whole idea of, I didn't listen to the State of the Union thing, but I saw kind of a summary of it. And I saw the part about, you know, oh, we're going to expand and like super forcefully put like, what, 4-year-olds in pre-K and all that kind of thing. And I'm like, yeah, because our current school system's working so great. We don't need to fix anything on that. Let's just suck another bunch of kids in there for something that's been kind of scientifically proven by all these studies not to be that effective in the long run.
It's totally not.
It doesn't make any difference at all.
Is daycare.
Like, what are you talking about? Why are you doing this? But I myself think that one thing that would help a lot of stuff is, and I think I've said this before too, a good apprenticeship program where you can opt out of high school at a certain point and go learn to be a plumber.
There's
learn
no to be a question. Butcher. You know, that's something
learn
else.
Learn to be a policeman. Learn
wrong.
To be whatever it is.
It's something else that's gone wrong in this country, in my opinion, is that everybody needs to go to college to be worth anything.
Yeah.
That is wrong. That is totally wrong. I mean, some of the best people I've worked with in my career have not been college educated. It's not a necessity. And I wish that that would stop, you know.
That's why I'd like that apprenticeship program.
Yeah, and that fits perfectly in with that. You know, in the school district, you know, I used to be the school board in the school district, and one of the things that we were working on is a charter school for, like, auto shop and industrial arts. So, you know, you'd have a kid who's maybe not doing so well in English or whatever who's completely interested in this other stuff. Well, heck, we can get you a high school degree or high school diploma. Mm-hmm. In this charter school where you'll be doing auto shop and wood shop and coming out with a trade, you know, our school was putting people out with computer certifications before they were out of high school.
Right. Well, and we've got, yeah, we've got a school like that. And yeah, they've got, you can take beauty less, you know, beauty lessons. You can become a beautician or a hairdresser or whatever when you're done, and mm-hmm. security type stuff. So you can then go on for further training. You can either try out for police or, you know, go do whatever. I mean, they had all kinds of things like that, which I thought was very good.
It is very good. So, wow, we went off the beaten path on that one.
Yes, we did. That's okay.
Yep. Please write to Julie at...
No. No, but anything about education goes to Scott.
Yes, I would love to talk about it, to be honest with you.
Yep.
Yep.
Let's see. Next time is... Oh, you've got a movie, right?
Da, 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 da.
That's right. Yep.
The Godfather.
The Godfather.
And I will try not to do any Marlon Brando impressions during that entire podcast.
I am ready to look for oranges. I'm ready. That's the one thing I know now.
Excellent. Excellent. Yep. And bring cannoli. Bring cannoli to the podcast.
And a lot of Catholicism.
Yep.
not really maybe the best Catholicism, I'm sure, excellent. Since there's a Godfather. But anyway.
Good deal.
And then
the book. Yeah. Book? Octavia Butler. Parable of the Sower.
That's it.
Yes, I haven't read that book for a while. I'm really eager to read it again, and interested to read it as a Catholic. That's one of the things I love about this podcast is when I read something, I read it in a new light. But that's got all kinds of religious stuff in it. I just don't know how I'm going to feel about it this second time through.
Yeah, I know. It's like, oh, I don't remember what exactly it was now. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and then we are going to do another, Catholic book?
Yes.
We thought in May, I think.
In May,
so
right.
Yep, I'd let people know, because this book, if anybody wants to read it who hasn't read it, it's a touch deep.
Yep.
And it's solidly good, but it is a little slower reading. So it's you chose it, right?
Right. I sure did. It's Jesus of Nazareth by Pope Benedict. Mm-hmm.
The first one.
Yep. Wow. And we picked that before we knew all the rest of this. So
I know.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting timing.
I know. And every time
we should have a new pope
it,
by Easter, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Because the rule is, see, this is, we were talking about this at the office with one of our people who's Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
The rule is you have to have the conclave within 15 days after the pope is gone.
Right. So by March 15th at the latest.
Right.
And I read some things that they're talking about pushing that up with some kind of a special dispensation thing or something. May or may not happen. But anyway, the 15th at the latest probably, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so then the Easter's the 30th.
Okay.
Or 31st. So
he'll be in there for a little bit.
Yeah. So you'd think that they'll have a day or two of meetings and mass and things, and then.
Yeah.
On to the burning of the papers.
Yes.
And so I've started reading Jesus of Nazareth just because I knew it was going to be slower. And it is. I enjoy reading it slowly, which I don't usually enjoy reading things slowly because it's so good, so mm-hmm. rich. I've just gotten out of the introduction. It was already great. But it kind of makes me a little sad.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say I'm just a little bit in mourning for Pope Benedict. It's almost like he died. I mean, I know he didn't, and I know he'll still be around, and that's really great because I'm hoping we get some great writing out of him. But because it's all about me again. But I feel like, I feel almost like he did die. I'm going to miss him so much because I love him.
I am going to too. And I wrote a little bit on my blog about how I felt, you know, when John Paul II died, he was the only pope I'd ever known, and I loved the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't imagine, it just didn't even occur to me that this pope would be anything close to that stature. I had no confidence that would happen. But it was mostly because I was still mourning John Paul II. And then Joseph Ratzinger got picked in there. And at that time, I didn't really know anything about him. I knew that what his job was and everything, but I hadn't read anything that he'd written. And so I really didn't have an opinion other than, you know, hey, he's not going to be John Paul II, because I was just bummed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, wow, just amazing. And I know that you and I have talked before about how, you know, John Paul II to me was like spirit with intelligence.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
Benedict is like intelligence with spirit, you know?
And with in such a gentle heart or something.
Yeah, there's just something incredible about him.
Yeah, and I loved John Paul II, the second John Paul II. Also, but I knew enough about Joseph Ratzinger that I had no hope anybody would elect him. He just wasn't even in my sights like most people. I was mm-hmm. just praying so hard for the cardinals to listen to the Holy Spirit and do yes. the right thing, you know, and not get all political about it. And when he was elected, I literally stood there watching the habeas papam, is that mm-hmm. it?
Yeah.
And I cried.
Wow.
I wanted to jump up and down. I wanted to, you know, go honk my car horn. I was so excited. And but I didn't know what to expect, but I just knew he was the guy I would have picked out of all of them.
Oh, that's great.
Because mm-hmm. I didn't know much about most of them, but I knew about him. I knew he was solid. And now, having read his books, it's just been 8 years. And in 8 years, I love him. It's from yeah. reading all his stuff and his, I don't know, he's just, you know, he's my papa.
Mine too. So,
yeah.
Yeah, definitely going to miss him. Yeah, got to respect his decision, and I've got to believe that he's yeah. doing it for the right reasons. And, you know, even though it was a surprise. So now I'm just, you know, what could be next? Trying to be confident, praying for the
Cardinals. I'm doing a lot of
very
fervent praying.
Yeah, got to do the same.
But, yeah, and I have to say the thing I love about John Paul II and Benedict the 16th is that they traveled this road together for so long. And, you know, because both of them were at Vatican II as young priests, or fairly young priests, and both of them helped write a lot of the documents of Vatican II. And then you have Pope John Paul II and Cardinal Ratzinger, you know, in there with him, helping him, trying to retire, and John Paul going, no, my friend, stay and help me. And then he's left to finish up his friend's work, as he said, Pope Benedict was. Mm-hmm. And then they're like bookends showing us, here's the two very different but very equally good ways. One way is respect people no matter how sick they are, how old they are. That's John Paul II's way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way is to say, I'm going to very humbly step down and not be in the spotlight anymore because it's for the good of the church.
Yep.
To have someone running it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, actively running it. And I'm just like, two wonderful examples of how to do it right.
Yeah, no question.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I just love that God gave us those.
Yeah, one of the things I talked to those kids about was in his statement how, you know, people would, you know, a lot of people have the wrong idea about the Pope. And I talked to him about how he said, he did not say, God appeared to me this morning and told me to resign.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said, after examination of my conscience, I have decided, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And we had talked about examination of conscience the week before. And mm-hmm. Incredible teaching moment. And I said, even the Pope. And here yeah. he is teaching us to the very last day.
Oh, I know. Think of what he packed into those 8 years. I mean, he wrote those three books and has done all those teaching homilies, those big series of homilies.
Yeah, I'm going to be reading those for the rest of my life. There's no doubt.
Oh, yeah. And then gone on all those grueling trips, you know, gone to Cuba, Africa, all these places. And, you know, you kind of feel like he's feeling weak, but look at what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Got rid of, let me just put it a different way, accepted the resignations of a lot of bishops and put a lot of very good bishops in their places.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly to be following good bishops. I don't know. But I'm just saying, you know, he's kind of got it set up as best he could.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, like you say, that teaching moment, and I've examined my conscience. I can only imagine how he struggled with it.
Yeah, I can't imagine. You know, he's been kind of hinting, you know, that something like this might possibly happen. But, you know, it's kind of incredible. And in January, I watched on TV his Mass. I think it was the Baptism of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And I was struck at how much trouble he was having. It wasn't quite the same as John Paul II, but you could just tell there's something's wrong. He was not energetic at all. He was doing this thing, but he,
not like
it took a lot of effort. Took a lot of effort.
Well, and I hadn't really seen any recent pictures of him at all because I tend not to watch. You know, I read what mm-hmm. he said, and so I was really struck when I saw a video recently, and then some just still pictures of him having to be helped up the steps.
Yeah.
And I was struck by how frail he looked compared to the other pictures that you usually see of him. You know, they're the standard pictures. And I thought, well, I hope that he has some time to enjoy some peace in that monastery.
Yeah, me too.
That they're redoing so he can pray and write and mm-hmm. contemplate. And
yep, I'll pray for that as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we went longer than we meant to, thanks to education and our Pope. But yes. Just had to be done. We're very sorry.
Absolutely.
But all this came up because of Jesus of Nazareth. So I did want to just say that, so if people haven't read it for a while and want to reread it, which is my position at this point, or haven't read it and want to at least get started before we talk about it, you have some time.
Right. Now, we decided to put a movie in there, too. So I don't think we talked about that. So after Parable of the Sower, we'll do a movie, and the movie will be Of Gods and Men.
Well, first I'll get my choices again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were going to put that one in. Okay, my bad.
Right, but see, this is February.
Yes, but I thought we were going to put...
And then April I'll do movie and book.
Okay.
And April's got 3 weeks that we'll do. It's the very last week of April we'll have our movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then mid-May will be the book.
Okay. Sounds good.
I misunderstood. Was writing it in my calendar.
Excellent. All right.
So, tell about the movie. That's good.
Okay, so where's the movie going?
The very end of April.
Very end of April. Okay. That's Of Gods and Men.
Yeah.
Kind
of an inspirational movie.
It's a very inspirational movie about a monastery. Yep. Okay, so.
So that'll be good. So we'll have, not necessarily like, you know, you'd say a Jesus movie,
mm-hmm.
but it's that kind of a movie, an inspirational movie we might or might not pick otherwise.
Sure.
There's no telling.
Right.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
So get ready, everybody.
All right. Yes. And thank you for listening. Thanks for listening. And thanks for whoever got us that finalist on that about.com Reader's Choice Award. That was really kind of cool. So thank you.
That was kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. We're in there with Father Robert Barron. Any Catholics will know that name. And I'm like, what? That and Praise You Go? And I'm like, I listen to that one practically every day. Oh my gosh. And there we are.
There we are. Amazing.
So now go vote. You can vote every day. So I'm expecting people to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll vote. No one else has to. The one vote a day, that'll be me.
That'll be me. Well, I'll be two.
The two votes a day.
But yeah, I love those other podcasts too.
That's right.
So, all right. Well, thanks again, everybody.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.